I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about a figure in English history, and I think in American history, who we don't study much today. We don't think about him much today, and maybe we don't think about enough or study enough. And that is the famous English jurist, Sir William Blackstone. Blackstone had a very significant role in the American founding and the thoughts of our American founders on things like law and constitutions, and has had a significant effect on contemporary constitutional issues like parents' rights in the education of their children, which is a hot topic today. And I'm joined for the conversation today about Sir William Blackstone and his influence on America by Professor Joe Griffith. Joe is the William Blackstone Professor of Law and Society at the Ashbrook Center, appropriately enough. He teaches classes here at Ashland University in classical learning, and he is also the director of the Classical Learning Program. Also teaches courses on political thought and the U.S. Constitution. And he has written widely, including on the influence of Blackstone on constitutional rights, especially the rights of parents to educate their children. Joe, thanks for joining us again on The American Idea.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Sir William Blackstone. We got some history nerds listening to this. They've heard of him. Maybe they know a little bit about him, but probably most of our listeners don't know a lot about Sir William Blackstone. Who was he?
Thank you. Yes, Sir William Blackstone was an English common law jurist who is most well known for his 1765 to 1769 four-volume commentaries on the laws of England. Blackstone was a professor at Oxford University, and this commentary is based on law lectures that he gave as a professor at Oxford in 1753 and onwards. Blackstone, he didn't really have a distinguished career as a jurist himself. He's most well known for reducing the English law to an orderly system, showing how it is a rational, coherent system, and that you can study it as a science.
So Blackstone is sort of an 18th century English legal scholar, legal philosopher, legal thinker. How important was he in people's legal education in the day? For example, would our American founders have studied Blackstone?
Yes, absolutely. There have been studies done to try to catalog the importance of non-American sources in the revolutionary period of American history and afterwards. A famous one by Donald Lutz in a 1984 American Political Science Review article says that the number one source quoted by American founding fathers was, well, actually, it's the book of Deuteronomy in the Old Testament, believe it or not.
Okay,
but
interesting.
But seconds to that, for secular sources, it's number one, Montesquieu, and close seconds is Blackstone.
Wow, that's amazing, actually.
Blackstone is the second most cited non-American secular source in the American founding generation. Why? Locke, by the way, despite his enormous influence on the American founding, is a distant third, and it's not close. Montesquieu and Blackstone are close together, but Locke is far, far below them. And if you track by decade, Montesquieu is quoted pretty frequently in the 1770s, But in the 1780s and 90s, it's Blackstone. Blackstone's commentaries were published, as I mentioned, in 1765 to 1769. But in the United States, they're published in 1772. In his sort of famous defense of the American Revolution, Edmund Burke says in this speech, he says that they have sold nearly as many copies of Blackstone's commentaries in America as in England. Blackstone is the second most, just by a hair, most important, most prominent secular writer during the founding era.
So that's amazing. I think a lot of that's amazing to me to hear that. I did not know that. I knew that lawyers in the day in America as colonials, English colonials, would have studied Blackstone, but I had no idea he made such a had such a lasting influence on their legal constitutional thinking. I'm thinking right now the question in my mind has got to be, okay, so tell us more about William Blackstone and his principles and the argument that he made.
Yeah, can I say one more thing about its reception in America? Certainly you have lawyers, young lawyers like James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, John Marshall, who read Blackstone. But this lasts for decades and decades afterwards. So in 1860, a young man writes to presidential candidate Abraham Lincoln asking him how does a young lawyer, a young aspiring lawyer, what does he study to gain a thorough knowledge of the law? And this is what Lincoln says, almost in his almost complete reply is this: the mode is very simple, though laborious and tedious. It is only to get the books and read them and study them carefully. Begin with Blackstone's commentaries, reading it carefully through, say, twice. For Lincoln in 1860, as a young, he says, if you're wanting to be a lawyer, start with Blackstone. It's what Lincoln himself did as he's prepping for the bar in Illinois in the 1830s. It's one of the few books that Lincoln has on his law library shelf in his office. There's rumors of him carrying it around while all four volumes while riding circuit in throughout Illinois. It has a lasting effect in the American founding and throughout in the lives of lawyers in this young American project.
All right, so let's start with Blackstone then. Tell us what Blackstone's main thinking was that was going to have so much influence on the course of America.
Yeah, so at first, I think I'd like to say that Blackstone appears conservative, but only at first. Or maybe that's an incomplete way that I'll have to unpack in a minute. In the 18th century, Parliament is passing laws left and right, often contradictory laws, and in response to the rapid commercialization of England. And so Blackstone takes it upon himself to make a defense of the age-old traditions and customs of English common law. He writes in his introduction, in a line that's come pretty famous, he says, "The common law of England has fared like other venerable edifices of antiquity, which rash and inexperienced workmen have ventured to new dress and refine with all the rage of modern improvements." So upon first glance, Blackstone seems to be, standing at history, yelling stop, against all the rage of modern improvements. And the commentary itself is written in a sort of unoriginal way. It's a commentary on the laws of England. It's not the first commentary of the laws of England. We think that probably one written by Nathan Statham between 1470 and 1490 is the first commentary. The idea is we need to get a hold of the often unwieldy case law in the English court systems. And so Nicholas Statham, kind of writes an abridgment, summaries of case law organized by topic. in order to make sense of what the English law is actually saying. Blackstone then, writing in the, giving these lectures in the 1750s and being published in the 1760s, writes to, against, or writes in order to educate lawyers and gentlemen about the traditional laws of England in order to provide some sort of stable order against the flurry, the hodgepodge of laws passed by Parliament. So upon first glance, Blackstone seems to be the conservative defender of the stable order of English law. The highest theme in Blackstone's work is about the relationship between nature and convention.
Okay, what does that mean?
Yes. Blackstone, perhaps a bit like John Locke, starts with the laws of nature and the natural rights of human beings. It's a familiar starting place. He even talks a little bit about a state of nature. But then Blackstone quickly, promptly, changes keys and turns to the laws of England and the rights of Englishmen in particular. Blackstone's message seems to be that while nature is the only sure grounding for human law, the laws of nature themselves are, at the end of the day, practically speaking, not all that helpful in deciding how to apply these principles in the day-to-day lives of Englishmen, for example. So the laws of nature, they're essential, but they leave out too much, or they become so general as to become almost meaningless in application. And so Blackstone's chief theme is how human beings can better understand the permanent principles and demands of nature by wrestling with them in particular political communities.
So if I can give an example that comes to my mind. So for example, would Blackstone have said, yes, John Locke is right, people have a natural right to private property, but that doesn't help me figure out what should happen if my neighbor's branch falls on my fence.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's not that Blackstone disagrees with Locke about the natural basis of individual rights. It's just that that's a first principle, and we need second principles now.
And he's arguing that, if I'm understanding you right, he's arguing we find these second principles that can really ground actual life, public life, and law in the English common law, in the decisions that have been previously made, as an attempt to kind of understand what the laws of nature mean in a particular circumstance.
In a particular circumstance, yes, that's exactly right. And that these principles come to light over a long period of time and by frequent recourse to similar facts in specific cases. So Blackstone, another chief theme of Blackstone's writing is the deficiency of statutory law to cover every possible circumstance or every possible exception
to
the rule.
Okay, so the law says I can only go 55 miles an hour, but my wife's having a baby and we got to get to the hospital.
Yes, right.
The law can't cover whether I can speed or not.
The written law is a blunt instrument. Yeah. And the example of rushing to the hospital, yeah, it's the perfect example. This is a theme that's not new to Blackstone, of course, right? You see it in Book One of Plato's Republic, where you should always give back what you owe. But what happens if you owe a weapon back to a man who has since gone mad? We see this problem in Aristotle's Politics in Book Three, where he talks about whether it'd be better to be ruled by the best laws or by the best king, the best ruler. And there's this problem for us, a people who live in a nation of laws, that the laws just can't cover everything. And even if it tried, it would be too voluminous to be of any use. And if it did happen to cover every circumstance While it is written, it'll grow more and more defective as time moves on. And so for Blackstone, the common law, because it develops case by case, but always with a view to first principles, the common law can fill every wide space that the statutory law cannot occupy. It can fill in the gaps. It could, by applying prudence, the prudence and wisdom of individual judges, it can soften the blow of the law or strengthen the law depending on the circumstances. Now, this doesn't mean that judges create law. It is rather that, and old common law commentators, especially like Blackstone, would say, we are discovering law as we work out these principles alongside with precedent.
Okay, so why is this important for the time of the American Revolution? Because it seems to me the issue now is you've got a parliament that declared in 1766, right, with a declaratory act, well, okay, we're not going to do the Stamp Act. We'll take that. We'll remove that. But we do declare that we can legislate in all cases whatsoever. Parliamentary supremacy. Parliament can make any law it wants for any reason on anything, and we all have to obey it. That would seem to say Parliament is sovereign even over the common law and the common law principles that have developed over centuries and centuries. Where is Blackstone in that confrontation, in that argument?
Yeah, good question. Blackstone remains a parliamentary supremacist. He interprets the Glorious Revolution of 1688 as establishing Parliament as sovereign. And it's the reason, I think, that Blackstone, funnily enough, opposes the American Revolution. He dies in 1780. Blackstone passes away in 1780, and so he doesn't ever see the end of the war or what becomes of this American project. But yeah, funnily enough, the American, especially the American lawyers, love Blackstone, even though Blackstone, in the end, opposes the colonists' revolt against Great Britain.
Well, you said, though, he seems conservative. His thought seems conservative. But the suggestion you were maybe hinting at was, but maybe it's not quite so conservative.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Right. Yes, right. So Blackstone is writing in, it's published in the 1760s. It's a response to the hodgepodge of parliamentary laws. He, however, sees English common law as progressing past what Parliament had said. So the common law is not a fixed system, but is rather a system of elementary principles and general judicial truths that are continually expanding with society. And so they're adapting themselves to gradual changes in trade and commerce, etc. So Blackstone, he gives, I had said, as you mentioned, that Blackstone appears conservative, but he, I think, is, in the end, a cautious reformer. He says, he gives this example of the importance of remodeling castles. He says, and I'll quote him here, "We inherit an old Gothic castle, erected in the days of chivalry, but fitted up for a modern inhabitant. The moated ramparts, the embattled towers, and the trophied halls are magnificent and venerable, but useless. The inferior apartments, now converted into rooms of convenience, are cheerful and commodious, though their approaches are winding and difficult." Blackstone seems to say that we need to renovate the old castle to make it fit for a modern inhabitant. We are wearing a conservative cloak. We are sort of not returning to these explosive and raw first principles. We are instead focusing on the particular rights of Englishmen, but these are going to change and the application of these are going to change and be modified over time.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So I think some of our listeners who follow the law and courts might think, that sounds a little bit like the idea of a living constitution. So, for example, the old English doctrine, a man's home is his castle. That means nobody can come in your house if you say they can't come in, even the king's servants. So the police or whatever need a warrant to come in. You say, well, why? Because people have privacy in their house. But then there's a car is invented, right? And so right. What does it mean? Do you have privacy in your car like you have in your house, or is that different? Is that the kind of thing Blackstone would have said, see, now we have to think about that principle and how it applies to a new thing like an automobile?
Yes, that's a great example from the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. The point is not that these fundamental principles change. Blackstone is clear. He starts, if they change, then they're not much worth, there's not much worth studying them. And if they change, then the stability of the order of English law, you lose that. And that's, as I mentioned, that's one of the key things that Blackstone wants to insist on. However, as times change, as, you know, I put more information in my phone than I do maybe in the safe in my home, we need to rethink how to apply these first principles to contemporary issues. And the way we do that is not simply by returning to those first issues of, let's say, privacy, for example. But instead, we need to trace how these principles have been applied in concrete cases throughout our history.
So did Blackstone think that judges could, as you say, fill in the gaps where the law, if the law has not said anything, for example, about privacy protections in an automobile, a judge, using Blackstone's thinking, could say something about that in a case in front of them? Say, for example, the police don't need a warrant to enter your car, or they do need a warrant. A judge could do that even if the law has never said anything about it, because automobiles are new in the 1920s.
The Fourth Amendment example is a great one of applying new principles, old principles to new circumstances. And for Blackstone, judges are uniquely qualified to do that, not simply by their education, which Blackstone is helping provide, but more so by this huge body of case law, which shows how to dispose of similar cases in a similar way.
If you have someone with this kind of thinking, I can see already how interesting he's going to be for American lawyers, many of the founders, of course, were American lawyers, and they studied him widely. When do we start seeing the influence of Blackstone and his way of thinking in the American Constitution and the way that American judges start interpreting our Constitution?
Yeah, great question. You're asking about the Constitution, but if we can even back up to the Declaration of Independence.
Sure, yeah.
The Declaration of Independence is clearly, in my view, a Lockean document. This is the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. Talks about the Lockean principles of natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or property. It talks about the rights to revolution when the government, which has been instituted by the people, no longer fulfills its obligations, and it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it. That first paragraph is basically copy and paste John Locke. But the grievances, the particular way that Jefferson and the committee and the Congress try to illustrate how King George III has violated their natural rights, the application of that principle is basically a long appeal to their English common law rights. This is a common law indictment against King George III. And I think that's a nice way of showing Blackstone's principles in practice. It's not that Blackstone is not a natural rights thinker. It's just that in order to show, to put on flesh, to put flesh on the bones of this natural rights philosophy, you actually need to show concrete examples. And the way you do that is by appealing to Blackstone's common law.
So what does that mean then for thinking about the Constitution? Because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And now we're starting to deal with, we're outside the realm of abstract principles or theoretical principles. We're starting to deal with how people actually have to live in a society under the supreme law of the land.
There are parts of the Constitution that do not make sense without reference to Blackstone. Specific phrases like the writ of habeas corpus, ex post facto law, good behavior, etc. These are terms of art that Blackstone helps define in his commentaries on the laws of England. Drawing from Blackstone, the framers of the Constitution, they presumed stability in language and continuity in law, except when a departure was needed, and at which case, and at which point they explicitly say, we're departing from these old orders. So the Constitution is a Blackstone common law document, except in these very important cases where it isn't. This idea of parliamentary sovereignty as an obvious example. Look at the way
under
that
the Constitution, Congress is not sovereign, right? We have three separate and equal branches of separation of powers and checks and balances,
which all draw their power from we the people in the several states. But yeah, you're right. Congress is not supreme in the same way that Parliament is supreme in the British constitutional system. Look at Article 3. We see a lot of Blackstone in Article 3. Judicial power is a presupposition rather than an explicitly stated term. Look at the way Hamilton in Federalist 78 presumes that judges in America are going to operate in the same way that judges in Great Britain operate, and that is by looking at rules, precedent, case law. Their training is going to look similarly. Article 6 declares that the Constitution and the laws made in the pursuance thereof will be the supreme law of the land. But I think we can see Blackstone's effect there as well, because the mode of enforcement of the Supremacy Clause is the courts. All courts, all judges are going to swear an oath to the Constitution, and so any disputes between state governments and the federal government will be decided by the court. Look at how that's different from the original draft of the Virginia Plan proposed by Edmund Randolph, or maybe just James Madison, whereby the national government will maintain its supremacy over state governments by means of a veto held by the national legislature. In Madison's original Virginia Plan, it's a national legislative veto that is going to maintain national power over the states. But actually, it comes from the New Jersey Plan, which I think in this sense is more in line with Blackstone, that the courts are going to enforce the supremacy of the Constitution. We also see Blackstone's effect in the Bill of Rights, especially amendments four to eight. The difference between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists on the question of trial by jury is the Anti-Federalists say that it is the bulwark of individual liberty, and the Federalists say it is a really important plank in our defense of individual liberty. But this idea of trial by jury comes from English common law as made orderly, as systematized by Blackstone. These are just some of the examples of the way we can see Blackstone in the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah. Those are very interesting examples. I'm not sure I ever thought of all those particular ones that we owe at least the explication of and clarification of to Blackstone. What about as time goes on in the American Constitution, and particularly you have written on a contemporary issue that's really important and really controversial, which is the right of parents to educate their children. Think of things like homeschooling, for example, right? Those rights are not in the Constitution, right? There's no part of the U.S. Constitution that says parents have the right to educate their children. So there were a lot of laws in states, as you know, and some of our listeners certainly do too, that required kids, for example, to go to public school and only public school. The state of Oregon passed a law essentially banning private religious schools. The state of Nebraska passed a law saying you can't educate your children in German after World War I. Well, all those laws might seem strange to us today, but that's only because we seem to recognize that parents have a right in some respects to direct the education of their children. You argue that that can be rooted in the philosophy and in the influence of Blackstone.
As you mentioned, the Constitution does not explicitly state that parents have the right to direct their children's education. In Federalist 84, Alexander Hamilton quotes Blackstone. It's one of two Federalist papers where Hamilton quotes Blackstone, the other one being 69. Hamilton quotes Blackstone in Federalist 84 to say that a Bill of Rights is both unnecessary and maybe actually even dangerous. And he quotes Blackstone as saying that the writ of habeas corpus, establishing that right, in other words, to establish the right that if you are going to be detained by the government, they need to provide a reason, that you need to show the body to produce the man and give the reasons why that person is being held. Hamilton says, look, the structure of the federal government as created by the U.S. Constitution is a Bill of Rights. In fact, explicitly delineating the various rights that individuals have, which is what the Anti-Federalists wanted in order to pass the Constitution, to agree to the Constitution in the late 1780s, to explicitly enumerate the rights is actually kind of dangerous because it flips the script. Why do we need to prohibit something that the federal government doesn't have the rights to do anyways? Why do we need to say that the government, that Congress may not abridge the freedom of speech if Congress doesn't have the right to do that anyways? That'd be a little bit like saying, if I'm a parent telling my teenaged kid to come home, be home at 10:30, and whatever you do, don't come home at 3 a.m. Well, which time do I need to come home by? Why would you suggest that I can't come home at 3 a.m. if I already couldn't do that in the first place? So Hamilton says that whatever other benefits the Bill of Rights has, and there are many, it's helpful to explicitly state which rights are protected. Whatever benefits it has had this harmful effect on the way American citizens think about rights. We think that we have rights because they are enumerated in the Constitution. And Hamilton says, quoting Blackstone, the federal constitution in its original form is a Bill of Rights. And it puts the pressure, it puts the prohibition on government rather than affirming individual liberty. So, in other words, the federal constitution creates an island of governmental power in a sea of liberty. If you write, if you attach a Bill of Rights, you kind of flip the script and you say, actually, we have an island of individual liberty. You have the rights to free speech, you have the rights to freedom of the press, but surrounding this island is an ocean of governmental power. So, all that being said, Hamilton, quoting Blackstone, wants us to see that we have unenumerated rights that are not listed in the United States Constitution. And how do we determine, though, what those are? So if there's one way to err, which is to say that the only rights we have are what are listed in the Bill of Rights, there's another way of erring, I think, which is just to say, we have whatever rights I feel like we have. And in this moment, I feel like we have rights X, Y, and Z. We don't have rights A, B, and C. And so we're just going to go with that. And both, I think, are wrong. Instead, what the court has tried to do in recent years is identify fundamental rights by looking at America's history and tradition. This is sometimes called the history and tradition test. What rights are fundamental? Those that have been held, particular versions of these rights that have been held monumentally, consequentially important throughout all of American history. And so what the court has done in cases about gun control, about abortion, about physician-assisted suicide, is to start at the beginning of the American legal tradition and walk through this history to see if there is evidence that the right in question has been held fundamental. And so my scholarship is a lot on parental rights, and Blackstone writes in his commentaries on the law of England that parents have three natural duties to their children, to maintain, protect, and educate them according to their station and calling, and that from these duties, parents have the power or the right to direct their children's education so that they are able to take on additional obligations. What I love about this image of parental rights from Blackstone is that this is not justifying the autonomous behavior of individuals, the preferences of autonomous individuals. This is tying together the duty of parents with their authority over children for the benefit of these individual children.
So where do we see this idea, for example, of parents, the right to direct their education because they have the duty to raise good people and productive citizens? Where do we actually see this in U.S. Supreme Court decisions?
Yes, well, you alluded to two earlier. In the 1920s, the Supreme Court ruled in two landmark decisions of Meyer v. Nebraska and Pierce v. Society of Sisters that parents have a fundamental right to direct their children's education. And in these particular cases, it was the right of parents to teach their children in the German language and the right of parents to send their kids to a private school. And so parents have these rights, and I think it's important that the court itself said, especially in Meyer v. Nebraska in its 1923 decision, that parental rights are among those rights long held at common law to be essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. In other words,
that almost sounds like it's taken from Blackstone.
It is, I think it is, taken exactly, yes, from Blackstone. This idea, Pierce echoes some of these themes from Blackstone, too. Parents have the natural duty coupled with the high right of preparing their children for additional obligations. And so if parents want to send their kids to a Catholic private school, They should have the rights. They do have the rights to do that. Not simply because the Constitution says so, but because of this long tradition starting from Blackstone, which has consistently held that this is a fundamental right for free human beings.
So would you say, is it fair to say that Blackstone is still important and influential in American law and in American society today? Even if we don't necessarily recognize him or know the name, except that I've heard it somewhere, does he still have the kind of influence that he had at the founding, or at least still have some influence today?
Yes, absolutely. The American founding was heavily reliant on Blackstone, and today is probably the second in American history, is a time period that this is the second greatest time that we are relying on Blackstone. As courts tried to figure out what counts as a fundamental right, as of now, the test that they're using directs them to dust off Blackstone, take it off the shelf and dust it off, and see what he says about a particular right in question.
Fascinating. Now you've made me want to go and dust my Blackstone off my shelf and take a look at this venerable old book. What an amazing insight, what amazing possibility that Blackstone offers to us for our study. Joe Griffith, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea to talk about this forgotten, but shouldn't be forgotten, William Blackstone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.